To get started with today's show, let's head to Rowan University's School of Osteopathic Medicine in New Jersey. We're about to witness a beautiful annual ritual. It marks a rite of passage for doctors-to-be.
All right, everybody, welcome. As you guys know, this is we just like to take an afternoon at the spring near the end of our anatomy dissections to honor and remember the people who donated their cadavers to our educations.
150 med students have come together to pay their respects to people they know almost nothing about. Not their names, their lives, their families, but they do know that these people have given their bodies to be used in education. They're singing, prayer, and poetry.
A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant.
As you chose to walk down in life, but I have felt the fibers of all the muscles that carried you there. I do not know what made your heart burst with love, but I have pictured how the blood flowed through the four chambers of your heart.
And at the very end, all of the students take part in one last act. Med student Tamir Rauf is emceeing the ceremony.
We'll take a moment of silence to share with your dissection teams and your cadavers before we all part ways.
The students then place white carnations and daisies across their cadavers' chests. A few moments pass, and then they head out, back to the med school grind. Here's Rauf again.
This is kind of a one-way street in terms of what's been done for us, and we need to find ways to make the sacrifice that these people made worth it.
Rituals like this, respectfully honoring the person behind the cadaver, are really common in med schools these days.
But it wasn't always this way.
This is Pulse reporter Alana Gordon. She's been digging into this history.
Because once upon a time, bodies were not so easily available.
In early European history, dissection was a crime worthy of hanging. In the United States, it was never technically illegal, but there were no official pathways to donate your body to science, and also nobody wanted their body to be cut open and examined. And so doctors and students resorted to some pretty seedy and even extreme measures to get bodies to practice on.
It all came to a head in Philadelphia in the late 1800s.
For this part of the show, we're collaborating with the podcast Criminal, a Pulse favorite, to bring you the curious story of a legendary outlaw and a big change in the culture of dissection in America. Alana takes it from here.
Evie Newman is looking for a brain, and more specifically, the brain of a one-eyed horse thief.
I would really love to find his brain. I hope that it's out there.
Newman is an exhibits manager at the Mutter, an old anatomical museum in Philadelphia that has skulls, tumors, and all sorts of body parts on display.
This gallery is organized by body part.
She's from Greece, but she calls this place home.
So we start with brains and go into hearts, lungs, and around the room to limbs.
Her nickname here is the wet specimen hound. She's good at finding preserved body parts in jars. What is it? It's green.
It's a brain with a large meningioma, which is a tumor of the brain covering.
But this brain that she's looking for went missing 120 years ago. And the scene of the crime, if you could call it that, Eastern State Penitentiary. This was Pennsylvania's world-famous prison all throughout the 19th century. Now it's a coveted ruin that attracts hundreds of thousands of visitors. The story goes that on January 21st, 1896, a prisoner at Eastern State named Alexander Leipzig, though some reports refer to him as Leipzner, went to check on his sick friend, John Frankford.
He seems to think very highly of Frankford. Apparently he was well-liked.
Frankford had been suffering from a badly infected dog bite. He also had terrible stomach cramps. So he was staying in the hospital wing, cell block 3, supposedly falling in and out of consciousness. It was a cold morning. It was snowing.
So Alexander looks for Joe Frankford, and he looks all over the place.
What Leipzig claims he saw next in the courtyard right by the hospital froze him in his tracks.
He sees across the yard a table with his friend's naked body on it. the doctor, the prison physician, is working on him. That's how he describes it.
Frankfurt is dead. Leipzig inches closer.
But he tries not to be seen. He doesn't want to be discovered. And he sees Dr. Bacon remove Frankfurt's heart. And he puts that on the snow, presumably to keep it fresh. And then he's working on his skull. And he opens up the skull and takes out the brain. And he sets that on the snow too.
This is the story according to a deposition Leipzig later gave to authorities. Newman's coworker found the document by chance at a flea market in 2014, and it really struck Newman. She's always been drawn to stories inside these prison walls and the notion of personal autonomy, even after death. She spent hours transcribing the faded antique cursive. She reads from it.
Afterwards, I saw the doctor go up through the seventh block to his office with the bucket in which were the various parts he had removed from the body. Two more other convicts who saw this, whose names I can give.
Frankfurt's daughter, Maggie Rittenhouse, didn't know about any of this post-mortem activity when she came in from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to pick up her father's body the next day. The official cause of death? Strangulated hernia, which he had been suffering from for some time. But something wasn't right.
And when they get the body, he has bruises all over his body. He has sewn marks. And the body is mangled because, of course, if organs are missing and his skull is cut open, it's really hard to hide that.
The daughter was deeply disturbed. Had her father been murdered? An investigation begins. Because John Frankfurt wasn't just any criminal. He was a famous horse thief.
I imagine him kind of a horse whisperer. Because he steals horses. To do that, you have to be able to approach a horse and get it out of its yard or keep without it making noise.
Frankfurt, supposedly a handsome guy with dark features, crossed the region from Ohio to Maryland, skirting sheriffs, stealing and selling horses. But his real notoriety came from his mastery at jailbreaking.
Frankfurt had the reputation of just not taking prison seriously. There's actually an article whose headline is, "He laughed at iron cells." So he's kind of an incredible figure. I almost admire him in a way.
One time, the keeper at Lancaster County Jail shot Frankfurt in the face during his elaborate attempt at escaping through the jail's stone chimney. The bullet swiped his eye. He lost sight in it. And so he gained the nickname One-Eyed Joe. Frankfurt met his match, so to speak, when he sent to Eastern State Penitentiary to serve out a 19-year term for horse theft. Eastern State's a mighty castle-like fortress. It's where solitary confinement basically originated. Frankfurt was nearing the end of his term when he died, and even though he'd been locked away for well over a decade, his obit was front-page news. Later, during the trial over his death, Frankfurt's friend Leipzig gave his testimony, as did the undertaker, the prison warden, and of course the head doctor, John Bacon, a graduate of the prestigious University of Pennsylvania. Newman reads from a newspaper account from the trial.
"Why did you take out the brain?" Dr. Bacon was asked. "Because John Frankfurt was a typical criminal, and I wanted the brain for scientific purposes." And he added that this was frequently done.
The news reports say Dr. Bacon admits to taking Frankfurt's brain for science. And then it's reported that he admits to taking the brains from two other bodies.
When I picture this trial, I kind of picture Dr. Bacon being kind of defensive about it, saying, "Of course we did this."
I talked to a researcher at Eastern State Penitentiary about this account, who was surprised. Skeptical, even, of this story, because the prison doesn't have any records of doctors taking organs for study. But other medical historians say it all would have been very under the table, and it would have fit into the broader practices that were rampant.
At the same time, the public consciousness is very aware of body snatching.
Yes, body snatching. Michael Sapel is a historian who's written a book all about this.
A body snatcher is a grave robber who takes a body out of a grave. They could also be called a resurrection man. The body snatcher term is mainly associated with medical grave robbery.
During the 1700s and 1800s, these resurrectionists made a killing digging up corpses and selling them to medical schools.
There are a few notorious examples of times when it became so lucrative that body snatchers actually murdered people in order to supply the anatomy department.
Now that was the extreme, but doctors and students had a problem. They needed bodies to dissect, to learn, but there wasn't an easy way to get them, at least enough of them. And when you think about it, the experience was really important back then. You had Civil War soldiers returning from battle, the emergence of the ambulance, new surgical techniques. Again, Evie Newman with the Mutter Museum.
How could you learn otherwise? Especially at the time when there is no medical imaging. There are no x-rays, no MRIs, no scans of any sort. So to see what's wrong with someone, you have to open them up.
This was also a time when medicine and even the broader public had an intense fascination and curiosity with the body. You had the rise of anatomical museums, like the Mutter, that would get unusual body parts and display them for study. Doctors amassed their own private collections. Contrary to nowadays, Michael Sapel, that historian who's written about this, says there was a huge stigma back then about being dissected for medical education, or even being autopsied, because how you were treated after death was really important.
This is also a time in American culture where how you die really matters to people. And if you're a poor person and you're saving money, the money you might be saving would be dedicated to your death.
Dissection for centuries back was often listed as an added punishment to those sentenced to execution. The easiest bodies to snatch were those of the poor and vulnerable, who didn't have money for cemetery security or a protected grave. These were African Americans, immigrants, those buried in potter's fields or who died in asylums and prisons. There was also an urgency to get bodies. Preservation science hadn't really advanced yet, so bodies would decompose fast. In the early days, even students sometimes got directly involved in stealing them.
Well, some of them get the bodies by going to the cemetery themselves to get them.
Meaning, like, they just ask for them? Like,
no, meaning they go in the dead of night and they might bribe a watchman, or maybe get a watchman drunk, or maybe they just look for the moment when the watchman falls asleep. And they bring in their wagon with their horse and dig and unearth a body and then away.
That sounds horrific to me, and I would imagine to a med student today. What was different then?
Well, part of it was this is a rite of passage. First of all, imagine the medical students back then tend to be younger. It's a culture of camaraderie and bravado. You want to curry favor with the professor? Bring the professor a body. Bring the professor an interesting body. You want to curry favor with your fellow classmates? I got a body. They are impressed with you. You're a brave, strong lad.
These students weren't always respectful in how they handled the bodies. And when the public caught wind of the unruly activity, riots would break out. In some instances, only being locked in jail could protect students from community outrage and even death.
Every medical school in the United States has a body snatching scandal. and there's a lore of body snatching in every medical school.
By 1878, the popular press reported at least a dozen body snatching scandals in America. And in 1882, just before that famous horse thief, John Frankfurt, was captured for the last time, when Philadelphia was exploding with medical schools whose reputations rose or fell on whether they had bodies for students to dissect.
I knew you would be asking us about Dr. Forbes. It's a pretty amazing story.
This is Michael Angelo. He's the archivist at Thomas Jefferson University.
Dr. William Forbes, the foremost anatomist in the country here at Jefferson Medical College, had a relationship with some people who supplied cadavers for the students. The local Philadelphia papers knew that something was fishy, so they basically set up a sting.
It was at a very large African-American cemetery. The crew camped out at night, armed with guns, ready to catch the crime in action.
And so you could call them muckraking journalists, no offense, but they actually got to the bottom of this because there were bodies being stolen every winter from these cemeteries. And so when they arrested these individuals, they squealed and said Dr. Forbes was the man who asked them to bring the bodies.
A mob stormed the courthouse. But Forbes never admitted to knowing this was going on. Think of it as a don't ask, don't tell when it comes to where the bodies came from for his lab.
But the damning evidence was that there were keys to the dead house, or the place where the corpses are kept at the college, in the possession of those men. And we actually have the keys in the archives today, so it's kind of a grisly reminder of where America was 130 years ago.
Forbes is exonerated. He returns to his medical post amid a mix of outrage by some in the community and relief in the medical world. Ironically, Forbes, now at the center of a major body snatching scandal where allegedly he had been fueling the trade, had been a leader 15 years earlier in trying to set up a legal way for schools to get bodies so this wouldn't happen. He had penned Pennsylvania's first law to provide schools with, quote, unclaimed bodies. But it was weak and it was hard to enforce. So Forbes then uses the Jefferson scandal as leverage to push through state legislation that would actually create a legal mechanism for schools to get bodies.
So as Philadelphia went, so did the rest of the country. The Anatomy Act of 1883 was a really important landmark for the entire country.
State laws regulating bodies for dissection were all over the map back then, if they even existed at all. Massachusetts was an early pioneer. In Pennsylvania, this act made it mandatory for certain bodies to go to anatomists, essentially legitimizing dissection in the U.S. And it did so by setting up an actual agency that would oversee the distribution.
If you go to the state archives in Harrisburg, from around 1890s onward, they have records of bodies of prisoners who have been executed, or indigent people, once again, unfortunately, who are unclaimed, where they indicate the person, their age, what they died of, and what medical school they were sent to. So it became a real kind of organized, rational, with a board making decisions.
The Pennsylvania Anatomy Act turned into Forbes's crowning accomplishment, and it was pushed through thanks to a state senator, who also happened to be a surgeon in northwestern Pennsylvania, who years earlier had been convicted of body snatching. But what about body parts? Back to the case of One-Eyed Joe, our legendary horse thief. The Anatomy Act is referenced because it came out just a few years earlier. But in news reports, it appears his case kind of falls through the cracks of it. Again, here's Evie Newman from the Mütter Museum, who's been following this case.
There is no clause in the Anatomy Act that talks about organs. That's never mentioned. So it appears that if you can get away with taking organs, you can. The end of the reporting of the trial actually reviews the prison as almost not responsible for this. and there isn't really retribution for it.
Shortly after the trial, Dr. Bacon leaves his position at the prison. But Newman says One-Eye Joe probably wasn't technically snatched for regular dissection, because during that time, there might have been a keen interest in organs for other reasons.
So, my guess is that they had their eye on him. This is a famous horse thief. At the time, the idea of criminal physiology and phrenology is fairly alive and well in the United States.
Newman is referring to the old popular study of the brain that gained a lot of interest in the 19th century. It's the idea that physical characteristics of the brain, like bumps, could reveal differences, so criminality could be identified in the brain and studied. There's also just a general fascination with unusual body parts, like those on display at the Mütter, and those of famous people, of criminals, for collector's sake, not even for science.
Like collecting, you know, Charles Guiteau's brain, who was the assassin of President Garfield.
Or that of pirates, murderers, or perhaps a famous horse thief?
I would really love to find his brain. I hope that it's out there. There is no real footnote about where it ended up. We don't know if it was sold by Dr. Bacon, if Dr. Bacon kept it, if it was returned to the family. There's no mention of what actually happens to his organs. So my hope is that Dr. Bacon sold it to one of his colleagues and it ended up in a collection and it's still somewhere out there in Philadelphia, hopefully.
How would you know?
It would probably be marked as the brain of a horse thief.
Why do you want to find this brain?
Just to complete the story, to get some sort of resolution. I always believed that seeing like an open casket funeral or the remains of your loved one brings a sense of closure. And this horse thief from, you know, the turn of the century has become a fixture in my life for the last 2 years. So I want to follow the story to the end and see what became of him.
The one image Newman has of Frankfurt is a sketch in his obit. I've seen it. In it, Frankfurt looks so melancholy to me. Like, as he once told his daughter, life is not your own inside Eastern State. But when I look closer at that one eyelid of his, slightly drooped over the eye he can't see out of because of a bullet that swiped him during an escape, it sort of looks to me like maybe he could be winking. Like maybe this is One-Eye Joe's final way of getting away from us all. His last great escape. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
The Pulse collaborated on this story with the podcast Criminal. To learn more about One-Eyed Joe and his life, check out their episode this week. It's on iTunes.